Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads crashing your comedy podcast party? Good news. Ad-free listening on Amazon Music is included with your Prime membership. Just head to amazon.com/adfreecomedy to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Enjoy thousands of Acast shows ad-free for Prime subscribers. Some shows may have ads.
Welcome to your daily affirmations. Repeat after me. Working with others is easier than ever. I strive for perfect collaboration. Our teamwork keeps getting better.
Yeah, affirmations are great, but Monday.com can really get you the teamwork you desire. Work together easily and share files, updates, data, and just about anything you want all in one platform. Affirm yes to start. Or tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
We acknowledge the Yuggera and Kaurna nations as traditional custodians of the land on which we work, live and learn, and their continuing connection with the land, waters and community. We pay our respects to them and their elders past and present.
All content related to this program is for general informational purposes only and contains stories and discussions around mental health that may be disturbing to some listeners. If you are concerned about yourself or someone you know, please seek professional individual advice and support. More details are contained in our show notes.
I didn't feel I valued myself for the first 29 and a half years of my life up until 27 April 1995, which was the first time I ever heard the word transgender. And at that point I realised was I thought, I've gone a long way down by fighting this thing, being gender. I wonder what would happen if I went with it.
That's diversity trans relator, speaker, educator and coach Sally Goldner AM, and this is Reframe of Mind.
The podcast that cuts through platitudes and gets to the core of living authentically, challenging our assumptions and improving mental health with the guidance of good science, philosophy and learning from other people's lived experience. We're your hosts, Andy Leroy
and Louise Poole. So what makes a good leader?
When we hear the word diversity, like it's used as the next hot buzzword, what do we think it means?
We see plenty of polarising statements and actions reflected back to us in our media from day to day, or even minute to minute.
Whether it's traditional formats like talkback radio and current affairs programming, or the social media platforms, there's never been a better time to get your fill of confirmation bias.
It seems odd now to think about a time before we could go online and feel satisfied about signing an online petition. But even they still need their leaders and advocates to get off the ground.
Sally Goldner is a powerful leader and advocate within her community and has enormous strengths any good leader would aspire to.
She's been advocating for change long before keyboards became the fertile ground from which we shout.
Sally first disclosed as trans in 1985, at which time it had only been 7 years since the first Mardi Gras in Sydney, which in 1978 was actually a protest march.
So I think it's easy to forget that amongst the glamour that Mardi Gras has become, that today's parades started as a march against a system that denied non-heterosexual people the right to love their way.
Yeah, and I think it was instrumental in contributing to the length of time it took me to come out, to be honest, because I came out when I was about 23. You know, a lot of that was all of the history of seeing images like that on the TV when I was 7 years old, and the comments I was hearing from family and people in our friendship groups or the family's friendship groups who were saying quite derogatory things about homosexuals. You know, the names that we later claimed as our own as a sense of power were actually hurled as insults at them. And to hear that kind of language really drove home the message to me that it wasn't okay to be that. You know, thankfully, the world's a lot different now.
And it's work that we still need to continue. I mean, over 40 years later, we're still not done. People from diverse communities still have to fight for what should be a basic right to be seen, to be heard, to be respected.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is why I love Sally's work so much, because what she centres on is diversity, valuing each person as the unique individual they are.
As we spoke to her, it became obvious that her approach was one of curiosity and humility to bring out the best leader in all of us.
So a little bit more background on Sally. In 1999, she became a founding committee member of what became Transgender Victoria,
which in 2013 was a major contributor to the additions to the Federal Sex Discrimination Act, covering gender identity, sexual orientation and intersex status.
Having not only been present for and participated in so much change for her community, we were curious about how it felt for her to know that she'd also directly contributed to positive outcomes in legislation in the continuing pursuit of equality.
What was it like being a early voice for equality? You were doing activism at a time where even just the, you know, lesbians and gays weren't accepted, let alone trans people. There must have been such a burning sense of something that you have to do despite that kind of adversity in front of you with that.
Well, look, I think in terms of the words have to, as an introvert, I've also had to sort of reclaim that part of me, or claim it even for the first time, because we live, I think, also in a very extrovert-dominated world. I remember in one of the introvert books I read, there's a saying that introverts don't necessarily speak up because they want the limelight. They speak up because of a deep sense of passion about it. So, yes, there was a part of me that wanted to speak up and get that visibility and understanding going. And then, as you've sort of touched on, definitely it was not easy. In a lot of circles, there were very few allies at that time. So, for example, when Victoria first added sexual orientation and gender identity to the state anti-discrimination law, there wasn't a lot of kerfuffle at the time about sexual orientation, but there was a lot of the stupid negative stuff about trans, and we only really had about two organisations supporting us. We had what was then called the Victorian Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby, now Victorian Pride Lobby, supporting us, and an organisation called Freedom Socialists Australia. That's a pretty low number for a major piece of legislation to get us on the board. So it did feel like at times we were fighting alone. We had to educate a lot of gays and lesbians about the legislation. And a lot were cynical and a lot, I can't remember, I don't think at any point there was any talk of dumping gender identity. For example, in 2010 in America, they tried to get some national equality laws through, and transgender people got thrown under the bus, and in the end it didn't get through at all. So it was very difficult at that time. And then later on, even, say, early 2010s, I remember at both the 2010 and 2013 election, we were trying to get, we didn't get, actually not 2013, sorry, but 2010, we were trying to get a raft of issues into mainstream media. And we'd get comments like, oh, well, you know, we're doing the gay stuff because we're talking about marriage equality, but in 2010, we didn't have any national anti-discrimination law here. There were all sorts of other issues, regulations with passports. So it did feel like we were sort of being, you know, asked to take a ticket and wait at times. And it wasn't easy trying to push through. And there were the, you know, I could, you know, recount the amount of stories and abusive transphobic and biphobic remarks that I've experienced. And it wasn't easy. And, you know, thankfully I did have various supports, but it also felt frustrating at times. I spent a lot of my mental health time having to debrief about the frustrations of this hypocrisy that we've touched on, rather than actually growing myself. So it was, you know, it wasn't easy at times, is the honest answer.
Do you feel like advocacy is your purpose?
Not so much anymore. That has faded. The issue that I'm really keen is about this issue of leadership and diversity in leadership, but also not just diversity in terms of who people are, but how we create more diverse styles of leadership, regardless of who the person is. That's becoming an even bigger passion now. And also, I'm one of these rare people who, you know how where there's a saying, most people would rather die than do public speaking. I'd much rather do public speaking than die, including talking on a podcast. And so the thing that I would love to do is I like to sort of give a full, I call it the extended dance mix personal story, which covers more than, say, gender and sexuality, but not just as a story, but what have I learnt from that? How does it benefit my leadership? That's sort of where personally I'm heading now. And I really want to do more of that.
Louise and I were commenting to each other this morning that really because of the work that you've done and advocates like yourself have put in over the years, our attitudes and beliefs are most likely influenced by the work of you and the people around you who have advocated over the years in so many ways. How do you get to a point of strength to shape public opinion and policy as a diverse leader?
I would say it is about things that sound basic but are obviously not simple, like persistence, momentum, trying to take a long-term view, which is not always easy when, even, of course, today we're still from a trans perspective seeing these sort of silly debates about changing rooms and toilets and that sort of thing, and people making horrendously vilifying generalised remarks. You know, when none of those comes along in the media and you've got to sort of motivate other people, calm people down, it's not easy. But I think the thing for me that I find now, sure, with, we'll say, the benefit of hindsight, is that having, to some extent, stumbled my way through and just trying to keep going forward, I can now see the difference. And I suppose I was, to use the word, visualising that difference some years ago, and now it is there. So we can keep moving forward. And, you know, slowly but surely, I think we are.
Do you find that some of those, for the want of a better term, bumps in the road that you describe, you know, when somebody comes out and makes a comment that's divisive or that does have the impact of othering people? I'm just thinking back to my own experience as a gay man when I came out, and I was really surprised and shocked at how people within the rainbow community could also other people within the community who are different to them. So I would hear derogatory comments against lesbians, against trans people, and I just couldn't fathom that. I couldn't understand why people who also had experienced bullying were then turning that against other people.
Yeah, it does seem hard to understand from, say, imagine I was doing the rabbit ears, inverted commas, a logical viewpoint. So we have to look at things like emotions and feelings to some extent. There's a few theories behind this that will say are explanations but not excuses, that when someone is being put down, rather than stand up for themselves, stand up for others, they just go, well, who's the person I can do the emotional buck passing on to? I don't want to deal with the feelings, so who's less secure and who's more vulnerable than I am? And so, yes, at times elements of gay men and lesbians have been biphobic and transphobic to me and bi and trans people. And yes, elements of gay men have been chauvinistic, misogynistic, toxic masculinity, etc. So that's one theory, the, you call it the emotional buck passing. The second, which I think has not been helpful for groups like bi and trans, has been this, the so-called assimilationist approach, where gay men, elements of gay men and lesbians would say, oh, look, hey, heterosexuals, we're just like you, except we're homosexual. Don't tell anyone. And the problem is that has thrown groups like trans and bi under the bus, because we were, again, inverted commas, too different, end inverted commas. And we didn't fit in as easily, and the issues were more complex. It's not just about, well, we just want to love someone. It's obviously more than that for those issues. Binaries are also a problem, either or thinking, you know, we've got to be gay or straight, night or day, etc., etc. But, you know, that doesn't account for the feelings of frustration at that irrationality. But the thing I would say now is that at least in some parts of Australia, I'll just keep to Australia for a second, gay men and lesbians have progressed some distance. As an educator, most times now we barely get any questions in the training, diversity training sessions I do, whether myself or with other organisations, about gay and lesbian. It's all about trans and intersex, who I would want to add a further behind. So I think it is now time to do for two things for gays and lesbians, not only to be allies generally to groups like bi and trans and start getting some equality and equity within rainbow communities, but in the same way as we need, in simple language, good men to stand up against misogynism in the broader community, we need good gays and lesbians to stand up against lateral hostility of all sorts within rainbow communities. And where there are individuals or organisations who are not willing to improve, then we need to band together to create that change, because I feel it's a big structural thing that holds us back. The only people who win are those who would exhibit prejudice, and that's not a win. You know, but how we get that through when people have their emotional blockages is important. I want to come back to that, I'll say, as a big theme as we got talked through this in our, was it 4 hours or 24? Anyway, because we could talk about this one for a lot.
Yeah, I think just to come back to your point there about how this assimilation attitude really does have a big impact. In my personal experience, again, I felt like that a lot of the acceptance that came from my family up until the point my parents died was the fact that I wasn't too different. You know, I had stable relationships, albeit with the same sex partner, but I was the loving uncle. I was towing the line, but as soon as my last parent went, one of my siblings decided to tell me exactly what he thought of me, which was probably not such a great surprise because I kind of felt like that was bubbling under the surface for a long time. But I kind of feel also maybe I've done myself a disservice by towing the line for all of those years and not standing up for who I actually am.
Yeah, look, I think there's mixed thoughts there. I mean, hindsight's a wonderful thing and we can only keep growing ourselves. I think that's the responsibility we have to ourselves as an individual and then to each other. I'm going to leap into something that's been a bit of a pet topic lately, and that's about leadership. You know, to me, leadership is about strengthening. I'm going to be bold and try to define it. Leadership is about strengthening other people. But we can only do more of that and do it more effectively when we strengthen ourselves. And that means growing ourselves and unlearning things. And I'm still doing it, which is another thing that I can talk about. As recently as only a month ago, I had a huge breakthrough about my perceptions on life. And so I think in fairness to yourself, you know, hindsight's a wonderful thing, but then it's about saying, well, okay, I think a psychoanalytical approaches of, well, what happened in the past can be helpful, but I find for me personally, if I try to move forward, I uncover the blockage anyway. And so I think when we try to move ourselves forward, when in the end we're wanting to move forward and there's something either blocking us, or we could use the example of a handbrake or an anchor or the analogies thereof. And then finally, when we hit the critical point, we can unearth that, you know, what's holding us back and then move forward more effectively. And I think that if we're going to do leadership better, whether it's in rainbow communities or any human, then we all have that responsibility, which is another big pet word that we could spend another 24 hours talking about. We've got a theme going.
How do you find a common ground in those cases with when it comes to leadership, when you're trying to teach people about the importance of having diverse leadership when people don't have those views or aren't really open to those views?
I think to some extent you are not going to win them all, and that's okay. And the answer to that lies in, you know, the best article I saw on, or a good article, there's obviously lots of good ones, but one that stuck with me, I'm still dining out with it 3 years on, was an article up that asked about the best values to do diversity well for an organisation or an individual. And one is curiosity, being open to learning. And how we cultivate that, I suppose that's, I don't have all the answers there. In the end, it might mean that people have to face some of their emotions, and whether that involves mental health work or sitting with their feelings, whether it means when we can, going to a gym and hitting a punching bag, whatever works. You know, it's about that perhaps unlearning or unblocking in a sense. And some people might not do that. It's the emotions are too big. They don't know how to deal with it. They're too scary. And so you're not going to win them all, but it is about trying to appeal to a sense of logic and humanity. I think it's about both. And that also leads into issues about gender in leadership in lots of ways, which is also another 24-hour pet topic. Yes. So,
it's the Sally Goldner show.
It's the Sally Goldner Wikipedia or something. there's just so much that comes into this. Ultimately, though, we've got to take that responsibility for ourselves. And this is why that's a pet topic, a bit of a button, so to speak, is for the last, at least in Australia, 25 years, it seems we've heard so much about individual freedom. But freedom and responsibility need to be closely balanced for each individual and for groups and society as a whole. And I think a lot of times we've lost track of responsibility. And in the end, we have to take responsibility for all our choices. And some are simple. You know, if there's a red light ahead, we'll stop because that's a responsible thing to do. Well, we hope anyway. You know, I just feel a lot of the time people won't take responsibility for their choices and likely consequences. So it is about that form of logic. But it is also about respecting that people have deep-rooted feelings. And I think when it comes to things that we'll call, whether we call it bodily sex, gender identity, gender expression, there can be deep-rooted emotions about that. So it's about affirming those and helping people then perhaps work through them. And that can work. But as I say, you're not going to get a 100% success rate with everyone. And then you just, make change where you can.
How much do you find yourself from day to day and speaking to different people and groups changing your style of communication to accommodate for where they might be in the journey?
Oh, look, definitely. So let's start with just one type of setting being, you know, one that I do a lot, diversity education. We try early on in our sessions to get a reading of the room, people's knowledge, say, on LGBTIQA plus overall, then trans, then intersex. And what we usually find, the proverbial bell curve, is that you've got people will put themselves overall at 5 or 6, and then it drops to, say, 4 or 5 for trans, and often people will say, what's intersex? Never heard that word at all. And so we can then fine-tune in. But there was one session in particular, which was in a multicultural setting where I think most people, perhaps English was not their first or only language. And we did an exercise, which is a dry humoured one, if you like, or tongue-in-cheek. It's called the mock heterosexual questionnaire. So it reverses back all those questions that used to be put on largely gays and lesbians. When did you choose to be heterosexual? What makes you heterosexual? Do you think your heterosexuality is a sin? And normally we'd get chuckles as we'd hand out the handout, that sort of thing. And this time we just got 20 blank looks. And finally a tentative hand creeps its way up and says, what's heterosexuality? It seems in this culture or culture with the particular language, they just didn't even have words or talk about anything like gay, lesbian, bisexual. So we had to really scale ourselves back to not just 101, but sort of like 002. Then on the other hand, we can get settings where we know that people are well ahead and we can just talk more about current issues and what's happening for them in their organisation, how they deal with things. Then going beyond training settings, I'll take a very different approach if I'm doing media work for Transgender Victoria, depending on the media outlet. If I have a sense that the outlet is, you know, at least reasonable or favourable, then I'll relax. But to give an example of where one day I got a call from a producer on a commercial radio program, it was about the time of, it was in 2019, where Victoria reintroduced a bill to reform birth certificate laws, which on this occasion subsequently passed. But I got a call from a producer of a commercial radio program going, presenter X knows your issues, but only wants to talk about bathrooms, which of course is blatantly biased media. Now, I have to then make different choices. In the end, I decided, well, I'm sick of talking about bathrooms, and I declined the interview on that matter of principle. But had I gone through it, I would have had to take a much more, I'll say, assertive stance rather than the more laid back and, you know, with humour stance that I would take in an education setting. So it is about adapting. Oh, and also if I'm doing, involved in some conversation, let's say there's a panel discussion at the Melbourne Queer Bookstore, Hares and Hyenas, then most likely I can move way beyond 101 to 501 or 701 or 901 or something like that. So it is about tuning in, knowing your setting, also trying to, as much as possible, minimise jargon where you can, but sometimes it is necessary, and then explaining it.
Oh, Sally, if you've got 24 hours to talk about trans activism, I could talk for 24 hours about problems in commercial media.
Okay, well, I'll just pipeline the coffee into my home office here.
I'll just leave you two ladies to talk.
I could go right off about that. But I think in relation to what we've been doing, like, that strikes us with the, I'm just trying to think of how to phrase it, because we're having this kind of conversation in regards to guests that we've approached for the show, and we've found that your typical, not to generalise, cisgendered middle-aged white man jumps at the opportunity and says yes and doesn't care what they'll be talking about. But the more marginalised the voice that we want to represent in this, the harder it has been to kind of convince them to trust us, because I think that so much of, marginalised voices have been reduced to one quick soundbite to fill a 30-second story, and that counts as people's diversity and inclusion quota.
And I think the critical word there is trust. An exercise that we do in our training, which is quite useful, is we ask people, it's called an X in a sea of zeros. So imagine a 25 square noughts and crosses board, but there's 24 zeros and one X stuck in the middle. And we then ask people, think of a time when you were the odd one out, and inevitably this is where you're treated negatively, or not inevitably, but in most cases, and then how did you feel? And the reason I bring that up is because, lots of LGBTIQA plus people have felt, say, guilt or shame or something like that. But at the bottom of my emotions have been two words, being abandonment in an emotional sense and mistrusting. And, the thing is, people, have felt let down by people and processes and systems and organisations and institutions with power. And my part of that, well, part of my mistrust was I spent all of my 13 years at what called itself an all-boys school. And so I obviously was not going to fit in there. But remember, this is throughout the 1970s into the early 80s when we didn't even have gay on the radar, let alone trans. There was just this, oh, toughen up, get over it, you know, all that sort of thing, which, and when I tried to reach out for help because I was unhappy, I was told that sort of thing. So I ended up mistrusting the people with the power. Going beyond my experience, I mean, here we are as the time of having this conversation. We are a year on from the horrific situation of George Floyd's death. And, you know, my mistrust and abandonment might be 1 or 5% of what people of colour, black, Indigenous people have faced. So they have been let down, and other groups as well, whether regardless of the extent of that, you know, groups like sex workers who are constantly mischaracterised. So, you know, it is very hard to get that trust going. Even sometimes now when I get a call from a good media outlet on trans, and they're asking for a certain particular sort of trans experience, I'll go on social media and say, oh, I've had a chat with the journalist and everything's okay, and then people need that. So there has been that sense of mistrust from a media, particularly commercial, that has not been inclusive, that has the, well, you know, middle class, you know, white men presenting, you know, say the news, and then they've got the very feminine female presenting, but white female at best as the occasional news presenter. And, you know, maybe I'm being a little cynical and overgeneralized, but they haven't done well on things. Where are the, you know, openly LGBTI people on major shows, including in particular people with progressive views? I mean, let's tackle a small elephant in the room. There's obviously debate in Australia about Kate McGregor, and okay, she's on the drum, but is she really representative of a lot of trans people? It's probably fair to say no. So there's, you know, if you've got the minority voice who sucks up, oh, that's good, and they just sit along passively, but we still don't have a diversity of views in terms of progressive nature, in my opinion, in commercial media, ABC, community media. And I shouldn't generalise on commercial media because some are better than others, but the larger, you know, commercial TV networks, commercial radio, and one print media outlet in particular, you know, it's been a huge struggle.
What do you think we need to do to move beyond the hashtag? We get to flashpoints every now and then with one community's needs or another where there is a lot of attention pulled towards us and then it dies down and it swings somewhere else. What do you think makes a good ally? How do we keep the momentum going?
I think you've half answered the question there. It is about allyship. So it's about people who have power and privilege to use my favourite adapted quote from Batman, who used their privilege for good and not evil purposes, Robin. And, you know, that is about where people have power. So people who are hiring for TV hosts need to make sure they advertise broadly, or commercial media, and, well, I could almost say, let's not even mention federal parliament. If federal parliament's still 30 years behind, remotely behind reasonable standard on women, as we've, well, I think we've seen reasonably so much in this year, without wanting to prejudice any cases or anything, where are they going to be on LGBTI? I mean, the only one who, you know, we've got people like, say, Janet Rice and Penny Wong, but who are there and do a reasonable job. But it just seems like, well, there's two names, where's everyone else? So it is about people will say when they get inside, trying to keep opening doors, holding the door open, to use a metaphor, to let more people in wherever we can. And we all, you know, we all need to do that as much as possible. And that can involve, again, a re-evaluation of our views and how we implement them. But if we don't, then we're going to just keep having, as you say, hashtag moments or a bit of awareness raising. And yes, we'll move forward, but will we undo the structural issues? I'm not so sure we will.
And that starts from the top too. Like, I think my experiences, like having worked in commercial media for 20 plus years, the people who are the employees, the people who are there, we want to make change. A lot of us do. We want to, you know, we want to tell diverse stories, but the pressure comes from further up the chain of, you know, that doesn't relate to your average listener, your average demographic who we're after. And there's a lot of black and white in that. But in that same vein as well, though, you know, we used to have things like diversity and inclusion studies anonymously come out every year. And every year I'd answer, well, where are all the people of colour? colour in this office, because in the whole time I've been there, I could only see two. Is that really, you know, tick boxes? How many people do I publicly know that identify, you know, on the LGBTIQA plus scale? Because, again, there was probably only three. But statistically, there would have been a lot more people, myself included, as kind of a closet pansexual at the time, that didn't feel comfortable sharing that, and therefore probably, you know, because that culture from the top is, even if it is of, yes, we've got to float in Mardi Gras, so we must be inclusive. don't speak about it, don't talk about it. First time I ever was able to mention anything to do with the LGBT community on commercial radio in a number one rated program was around the marriage equality survey, and I was frightened to say that at the time. So yeah. I mean, that's 2017. It's not that far ago.
Yeah. Oh, look, I totally agree. And there's lots, I mean, there's a mountain to unpack there.
There's another 48 hours.
Yeah. This could be, let's go for the world. Guinness Book of Records for world's longest podcast. Pipeline the double strength coffee.
I don't think I had a question there, Sally. I think I was just venting my experiences with, you know, and not even just for the, you know, LGBT community, but for all marginalised communities, you know, there are no people of colour, not many. There's some female leaders being amplified in these situations, but not many. Then there's that kind of level of equity, not just equality, because there's been less resources put towards growing these people. Oh, yeah, they're not qualified for the job, but have you backed them to push them? Have you taken anything else into account of why they might not step up as much as, you know, that kind of stereotypical generalized man that has never been told?
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening on Amazon Music is included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Just head to amazon.com/adfreetruecrime to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Enjoy thousands of Acast shows ad-free for Prime subscribers. Some shows may have ads.
Welcome to your 2023 work recap. This year, you've been to 127 sync meetings. You spent 56 minutes searching for files and almost missed 8 deadlines. Yikes. 2024 can and should sound different. With Monday.com, you can work together easily, collaborate and share data, files, and updates. So all work happens in one place and everyone's on the same page. Go to Monday.com or tap the banner to learn more.
Get ahead of postage rate increases this year with Stamps.com. It's like your own personal post office. Sign up with promo code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Look, they're not good enough?
Well, look, in my best Dr. Phil voice, you released your feelings. And the thing is, there's actually lots in those feelings that actually do form a good basis for conversation. I'll do a small one, knock it over first.
Go on.
Well, I'll go to the big one. I think that we hear a lot, well, sometimes we don't hear about organisations and values. And then sometimes, yeah, we've got an organisation that points to a values statement. But I got a really good diagram about this on a webinar I was on a few months ago. And imagine the proverbial archery target, and sure, the bullseye in the center is values, and then the next ring out is behaviors. And so the problem is when behaviors aren't consistently don't reinforce those values, or where people don't look at their behaviors and go, oh, hang on, we're not matching here, that's where things break down. Or they might apply things inconsistently. They might, as we've discussed, they might do gay and lesbian well and not do bi and trans well enough, or whatever it is. And yes, this happens in LGBTIQ community organisations where there's been this inconsistency. And the other rings, as we go outward to the perimeter of the archery target, trustworthiness being an attribute, trust itself, and then image. So, of course, if it isn't applied consistently, everything breaks down. And I think people do pick up on that. So it's about how we reinforce values all the time and make sure that we're consistent. And I think it can flow from there. Well, at least I've seen a notable difference where that is what happens. And it is also about I don't like hierarchy at all, for lots of reasons, and that maybe comes back to my mistrustful type of stuff. You know, I suppose trying to be objective when hierarchy can use its power more wisely and in a more balanced way, then that's okay. So it does need to come from the top down, because we live in a, for whatever reason, so many of our structures, whether it's business or government or not-for-profit structures, are based on hierarchy. But it's not hierarchy itself, as I say, that's the problem. It's misuse of power in a hierarchy. There are still too many organisations who think that, oh, well, march in Mardi Gras and cover ourselves in a pile of biodegradable glitter and see, look, we're inclusive. No. If you don't do the work, what happens when that trans woman rings up and in this conversation goes something like, good morning, Organisation X, can I help you? Yes, I need to speak to Louise. Yes, sir, what's your name? Mm. Well, they haven't done the work. So the thing about being inclusive, which links into the values and behaviours, it's about doing the work and then communicating it, but one without the other isn't going to do any good. And the last thing, and this is one of my pet topics that I noted to come back to, so we may as well do it now, is that, well, there's two more. One on women in leadership. I think that so much of our models of leadership, our theory on leadership, our texts come from, I'll use the phrase in inverted commas, a male and or masculine and inverted commas approach. Where have we seen female, people, females write about leadership? I am, if I get ever get some spare time, I'll get through the book, which is co-authored by Julia Gillard, along with Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala. And it seems there are other people thinking about it. Well, this is something that's really been on my mind in the last few months, both due to personal circumstance, but also, yes, what's happened in federal parliament, that we have such a macho, sort of chest-thumping sort of approach to leadership, which is not leadership, and it's been measured to be a bad approach. But also, what do LGBTIQA plus people offer in terms of different perspectives of leadership? And then, whilst I can't speak for other people, I'm sure there are other people who can offer ideas on leadership from a diverse perspective. I suppose the other last thing that came out of this, because it is a rich sort of point, is that I think that people, when they are marginalised, I call this personally the topsoil effect, that you've got to dig through the topsoil of, say it's for me, by coming out as bi and trans, and then you've got all your things to unpack underneath, and maybe you don't, which makes it harder as well. And yes, of course, there is bias from the proverbial cisgender, white, heterosexual, middle-aged males. That doesn't help. So it's how then can we take a more trauma-informed approach to leadership and build people while and help them gently recover so that we get some equity as well. And trauma-informed goes even further than what I'll call female/feminine leadership. And I think we need to do that in lots of settings of all background, of all types.
How do you think you overcome your own internal biases? I suppose I think in terms of, I often talk about like this idea of comp het, because I feel like I'm a late blooming identifying as not straight, and that's because of like that wasn't, it's just, you know, wasn't a thing, you know. If there's an attraction to men, then I must be straight, until you look at it and go, well, what about all the other things that you're not admitting or talking about? And those are internal biases that I had, you know. I think in my early 20s I probably would have said, oh, I'm very straight, but also in the same sentence said, but I don't really find men all that attractive and women are far more far more attractive. Yeah. But that's just, do you get what I mean, Sally?
Yeah. Look, we have these emotions that take deep root, and as I say, then they're buried under that top layer of coming out in the first place. And then we've all got stuff as a person, I suppose, that combines in with it as well. And if a person is a heterosexual, cisgender, etc., then maybe they don't think to tackle it. But I know for me, I found that once I sort of started going down the rabbit hole, sometimes I didn't really want to keep going, but I suppose I did. But it is about wanting to learn and taking responsibility and having the willingness and ability to face these things. And some of those things, as I say, can be too strong to face. That's not easy. And so that we can remain blocked. And to give an example of my own bias that I had for a long time, I thought because I'd gone through stuff in terms of trans, in terms of bi/pan, to use my own labels, what prejudice I'd faced in terms of neuroprocessing, I sort of thought, well, I knew could understand everyone else's feelings and experiences when they face discrimination and prejudice. And I think, again, to come back to what we're talking about with what happened a year ago, and as I started learning more there, I realised that, no, there's no way I can understand what it's like to be Black, Indigenous person of colour. And so we have these beliefs that perhaps gather in us, and it can be various forms of bias. We've all got it. And I think that whilst to some extent that can be an issue, it's how then do we respond to that? Do we go, oh, I'm not going to do anything? Or do we run away? Or is it too scary? Or do we just say, okay, how can I gently tackle this so I can perhaps reduce some of my bias? It's not easy. I think that has to be acknowledged when we've had deep-rooted beliefs and we've heard, coming back to just LGBTIQA+, we've heard so much huge, intense negativity for years. It's not easy to leave that behind. And, you know, only just hope to keep doing a bit better. What is it? You know, you see people on Twitter with the description working at being a better human or something. Well, trite as that is, it's quite reasonable. So we can only just keep going and be gentle on ourselves.
Do you think that we sometimes get too caught up in labels and genitals, and that maybe sometimes we just need to take a step back and acknowledge that we are all just human beings trying to do the best that we can?
I think there's mixed thoughts there. Labels are still important for people when you're trying to find something to get yourself out of those deep emotions. A label can be the person throwing the rope over the cliff edge when you're hanging on by two fingernails. That can be really, really important and heartfelt and give you a starting point. And rather than being in a state of uncertainty or lack of clarity, labels can be that, oh my gosh, I fit that, yay, and can give you a starting point. And so I think they're important. It would be in a utopian world nice if we didn't need labels and we were 7.8 billion humans full stop. I sometimes talk about, is there one box of 7.8 billion humans, or there's 7.8 billion boxes, one for each human? Well, it's kind of bits of both. Let's bust some binaries, to use my favourite say. And we do have similarities. We need food, we prefer shelter, we need to sleep, those sorts of things at a very basic level. But then it's about how we value difference rather than see it in a negative light. It takes some effort to do that, to keep ourselves as balanced as we can in the face of that. So I think that labels are important because they give people a sense of affirmation. Maybe in a utopian world, we get beyond labels, but we're probably not going to be there for a while yet.
I see sometimes this debate between the usage of the word pansexual versus bisexual. I like the word pansexual, but it could just be to do with my age and the time in which I feel like it applies to me. But we shouldn't be debating the semantics of things like that, though, should we? Like, we're focusing too much on getting caught up in that.
Well, I mean, given that people, I'll say, who are attracted over the course of their lifetime to more than one gender, which both bi and pan cover, I agree with you that there's a lot of hair splitting. And the thing is, bi and pan people get some nonsense from the broader community, but also, as we've touched on, elements of gay and lesbian. And so really, is that the most important debate we could be having when we've got other things to talk about? So thankfully, when this debate has sort of got out of hand a bit at times and people go, but bi means two and you're erasing non-binary people, people say, well, no, it just means you're attracted to two genders. It doesn't say there are only two genders. And then people say, now we've sorted that out, can we get back to just valuing people, that sort of thing. So I use bi and pan, both bi and pan, for myself. I originally heard the word bi in 1997 when I was sort of, say, working through sexuality or becoming clearer on it. I think it was as I began to get onto the right road, it was like the fog lifted on so many things. And I realized, well, at that point, okay, I could be attracted to men. And then there wasn't a lot of talk in the late 90s about pet genders, or say beyond male or female, if I can put it that way. And it wasn't until the early 2000s when I heard pansexual, and also there was more talk about, you know, sort of more than two gender identities in particular. And so they both resonated for me. They both have an emotional, heartfelt connection. And so that's why I use both. I'm not saying I'm, over the course of my life, if you put, say, 1,000 people in a room and I was attracted to 100, there'd be 33 and a third who were men, 33 and a third who were women, and 33 and a third whose sense of gender identity was beyond male or female, including no gender identity at all. It might vary a bit, but it's still, gender's not the first thing I look for. And to me, bi and pan are both saying that, as are labels like multigender attracted, omnisexual, polysexual, whatever we want to call it. And so, yeah, I think there's a bit of hair splitting, but also labels are very important for people, and, you know, people have a right to define themselves and their label in a way that feels good for them. So it might not be everyone's got the same words, but I think it's roughly in the same ballpark, and that's the biggest thing.
How do you balance your own mental health in this process? Because it must be exhausting to hear stories where people in the community are persecuted, still victimised, still going through these things. But you bravely tackle that in raising awareness about it. But also, it must be a trick to balance the mental health in not taking too much of that on to affect your own self-worth.
It's a fair call, and I'd be honest and say that I probably haven't looked after my own mental health and done self-care generally in lots of ways as well as I could have. But I have kept learning. And so I suppose if I'm asking now what are three things that work is, finally, I did get a form of exercise going that worked for me just over three years ago, and that's swimming. And it's not just a physical exercise, which we know is good for mental health. It just is almost to me a holistic form of exercise. So even as we have our conversation this morning where it was drizzling rain in Melbourne, I still went and did it. And of course, once you're wet in the pool and it's warm enough, it doesn't matter. But swimming for me is almost like a form of meditation. I get in, and sure, my thoughts about what's been going on in my life are going through my head, but they drift out. They're sort of pushed out, and I get to the end of the first lap and it's one, and then two, three, four. So it's a very holistic and relaxing form mentally, emotionally, maybe even spiritually as well, which has worked well for me. And my mental health has been a lot better, and it's had to tackle a lot of difficult stuff even in the last few years, as I said. The other thing, having a sense of humour. This is something that I do notice a lot of younger activists in, I'll just stick to LGBTI, sometimes they don't seem to laugh at anything. And I'm not just talking about, so when I grew up in the 70s, having a dad born in the UK, there was so much UK comedians and sitcoms which probably would not even get anywhere near a pilot now. And yes, I acknowledge that by today's standards they are politically incorrect, but I suppose I laughed at it, and the fact that I can laugh at myself for being able to think about that way. So, I grew up one show which was the two Ronnies, and yes, they probably did things that were inappropriate, and particularly on gender, but also I don't think they were, in any way really, in terms of gender, I'll specify that they weren't malicious. But laugh at something, I think is a good thing. And the third thing is whatever self-care works for you, and here's where I can laugh at myself as well. I'm a fan of what is colloquially called sports entertainment, i.e. professional wrestling. So I subscribe to the WWE Network, and there's nothing more soothing than watching someone throwing someone over the top rope and thinking, gee, I'd like to do that to some fundamentalist religious types. See, it's meditative. Are you going om at the moment? But seriously, turn off from, find something that turns away from the day-to-day stresses of advocacy and people who sadly are facing difficulty. You've got to do something like that. Well, I won't say publicly that I deliberately plan my schedule so that when the various monthly pay-per-views come in, I've blocked that out in my diary and no one can book training for me. I didn't say that publicly, but I give myself that little luxury of, okay, I'm not doing some actual work on a weekday because I really want to watch this. And, then it helps me do the rest of my work more productively and better anyway. So I think you've got to do some sort of self-care mentally, physically, spiritually, emotionally. And that's, of course, whatever works for each individual. Bushwalking, going to the gym, hitting pillows, whatever it is really important. Now, remembering to turn off the PC at some point, I'll just do a few more emails and then a few more come in. It's like you're on a treadmill. Get off the treadmill is important. And I'm not perfect at it. I'm very dedicated and diligent sort of thing. And I have to remember to look after myself sometime.
Are there tools that I suppose you've learned through your life, your experience, that not necessarily in a LGBTIQA+ setting, but could apply to everybody who wants to further their understanding of themselves, remove those, self-limiting beliefs they have about themselves, Are there any words or tools that you would say to them?
I think be open to different forms of learning, and there's a few things that just leap to mind on that question. So I'd taken from 1995 onwards somewhat of a, we'll say, a mental health approach, which was helpful. However, in 2003, I worked with a life coach, and not a rah-rah, you can believe in yourself life coach, but a really sincere, authentic woman who was just wonderful. And the thing about life coaching, yes, you set goals, but it's about your learning along the way. And that was possibly the first big unblocking or unlearning that I did. But that wasn't related to, I'll say, an attribute or a characteristic. It was just a view that I had as a person. And the thing that I learnt at that time was that, reasonably enough, up until that point, I'd taken a very glass half empty view of the world. And, well, with reasonable reason, as I say. And the life coach just gently and objectively pointed that out to me. It was like, oh, wow. And the interesting thing was, I'd been experiencing a form of depression called cyclothymia. I will always have it. But about 80, once I decided to change my view and try to find more positives, about 80% of it went away overnight, which was pretty amazing. I'm not saying that'll happen for everyone, but that's the sort of thing. So be open to different forms of learning. So I was taking more of a cerebral or abstract form of learning throughout, say, the 2010s. And then in 2014, I got invited by a friend at the time to do a course that combines gentle elements of BDSM and Tantra. And so that really got me into my body more. And I had not wanted to perhaps get into my body, which was partially a trans thing and partially other things, being bullied for how I did sport at that so-called all-boys school, really had left me with a low sense of, I'll call it, body self-esteem, not because of its size or its shape or necessarily its gender or sex, but how it functioned. Doing that course began to shift a lot of blocked energies and made me feel more confident in my body and doing other similar work. So be open to different styles of learning. Yes, again, come from a place that is your strength to start with, but then try to look at other styles. So I don't, again, it's going to be whatever works for each person. And some people like more individual settings like counselling, and some people love groups too. If it is learning that you're doing of some sort, it's got to be by a safe process. And that's, I think, the critical thing. You've got to feel safe and comfortable. And that was the thing about that 2014 course. The process that was set up was so safe. I was able to move myself forward again gently in a way that worked for me. So yeah, no all or nothing answer there. It's about finding out what works for you. And I think finding out what works for you will then help you be more open to learning in itself, and that will become exponential.
It sounds like with that kind of self-discovery journey, it's less about, again, a binary choice, you know, therapy or life coach. It's actually going out and seeking whatever else might help you along the way.
Yeah, and just being open to opportunities, open to possibilities of both what and how things are done. How, to me, is such a critical word. I think, again, perhaps linking back to gendered leadership, we're so focused on results and outcomes, we forget about processes and journeys. Understanding the how, which is so important, is, I think, critical. And so, yeah, just be, you know, be listening. You never know when someone could say something in a conversation. And if you're tuned in the present moment and your intuition's going, oh, that could be something interesting, you can then be open to a chance to learn, even if it's not a structured course of any sort. It's just that little bit of learning that could be a difference maker. So yeah, just being open, I think, to that possibility when you feel safe is really, really important.
One of the quotes I wrote down out of, I forget which video it was that we watched this morning that had you in it, you said, imagine if we stop limiting people. And that resonates very strongly.
Well, we do limit people. You know, let's come back to gender as the obvious one. I mean, 20 years ago, there was a book title. Now, whether it was a clickbait title or meant sincerely, I don't know. But either way, it was pretty blur, so deep breath. Why Men Can't Listen and Why Women Can't Read Roadmaps. Mm. I mean, seriously. And it's just like, what a limiting thing. And this is where, for me, words like masculine and feminine are limiting. And it doesn't really matter whether they're constructs or not. It's just to me, anyone, regardless of their body at birth, their body now, their sense of identity, has a range of skills that society has arbitrarily just decided as things called masculine and feminine, as opposed to male or female. So simple one, masculine people can do maths and feminine people are good at empathy, but that doesn't talk about whether someone's male or female. So of course, there are those things that we need to talk about. And this is the other thing I wanted to talk about leadership and gender, is how it comes back to how limited our skills are. One thing that I've been doing lately when I get the chance is asking people, so in the first roughly 18 years of your life, whether you were at school, homeschooled, no schooling, anything else, who taught you listening skills? And I've only had one person say they learnt any in the first 18 years of our life. Let's unpack that. Listening is considered a, in inverted commas, woman's thing, a feminine thing. There's where we could do a basic skill that gets beyond gender limitations. And imagine if we all listened better, perhaps we'd have it packed, all everything fixed by 5 o'clock Friday week in time for drinks. I mean, you know, it would go a long way, because people are taught how to talk, which is the male thing, because males are the ones doing the talking. Mm. You know, there's a sense of unconscious bias on how limited we can be because of the limitations. But really, of course, when we get past things like that and say, well, we've all got a particular balance or mix of skills in us, start with the ones we're best at, definitely, and then keep building up the other ones. And, you know, and so long as that's coming, and here's my big thing for leadership, so long as it comes from a place of kindness, including kindness to oneself, then really that's a good thing. And so, yeah, it just comes down to keep growth and learning, which are, you know, human basics.
What was the point that you realised that you truly valued yourself?
Wow, there's a good question. Well, let's start. I suppose I'll think that out loud a bit. I mean, I didn't feel I valued myself for the first 29 and a half years of my life up until 27 April 1995, which was the first time I ever heard the word transgender. And I suppose to some extent, I remember very vividly that day, and I drove away from the psychologist who told me that, and my mind was so rapidly reprocessing everything because it was a whole reframing. I couldn't drive anymore. I had to pull over. I wasn't very focused on the roads. So I did the right thing and pulled over and just sat there for a bit rather than go on to wherever I felt I needed to go. And the thing that I suppose at that point I realised was, I thought, I've gone a long way down by fighting this thing, being gender. I wonder what would happen if I went with it. So I suppose in a sense that was the first thing I ever did that I really felt where I valued myself and did something that I valued in myself. But it was still only one moment. And I feel like, you know, for the first 29 and a half years I was taking a road, in simple terms, going south. Okay, I hung a U-turn and started going north. But it took a long time to undo the negative beliefs I had about myself. And maybe I didn't really begin to feel somewhat valued until 2010, when I won a Melbourne LGBTI Community Award. At that time, they were run by an organisation called ALSO, and I won an award. And that was really validating and helped me validate myself. So it is about when sometimes we do need some affirmation and validation from the outside to value ourselves, and then perhaps things have gone on from there. But of course, you don't necessarily have to win any awards or anything. It's just some, you know, it's just about getting some degree of affirmation, but also knowing how to receive it. And the first part of my life meant that maybe I didn't know how to receive whatever good stuff, if there was any there. And it's taken me a long time to learn that. Because of what I went through. And in that sense, it's still, you know, the breakthrough I only had a month ago was I realised, obviously, that a so-called all-boys school was not a pleasant place because of gender. But it was because that when I tried to reach out for help to anyone, no one really gave it to me. No one listened. And that had created such a deep block about being able to receive anything, whether it was information or, in the broader sense of the word, love, information, affirmation, and in the broad sense of the word, love, because I had always felt been let down. And so I was very wary of people who tried, in inverted commas, to help me. And so, you know, it's sort of, growth, as they say, is circular, not linear. And so I've sort of gone through another circle. I've gone through circles in stages over time, and am feeling in the best position I could be in now, or best position I have been in up until now. But, you know, there's still probably distance to travel.
It reminds me of that old proverb of before enlightenment, collecting water and chopping wood, then after enlightenment, collecting water and chopping wood. Coming out when people are able to do so and feel safe to do so can be a very liberating experience. Mm. But also within that, there's the importance to remember that there are still people out there who do seek to harm us or to do us wrong. And that I suppose what I'm getting at is there's still a sense there that we do still need to be careful and look out for each other.
Definitely. I mean, I consider myself fortunate and grateful that I live in Melbourne, which by and large is going in the right direction, particularly in most of metropolitan Melbourne. But of course, there are lots of people, even say parts of some suburbs of Melbourne, where it's still not so good on the outer fringe or in regional or rural Victoria. And then of course, there can be very conservative areas of Australia and then even more conservative areas in the world. So we do have to be considerate of that. And also linking back to our earlier conversations, you know, it is generally, if I'm just being one-dimensional, for gays and lesbians, easier to come out still than, say, for trans and intersex people. Whilst it's not my lived experience, don't necessarily come out, but we'll say disclose, there can be possibly issues there as well. So it is about not just location, but parts of the rainbow communities who some have progressed more. So we do need to be mindful of that. And I have to remind myself sometimes that to some extent, hang out in the proverbial bubbles of life. And I think bubbles are okay. We need them to regroup ourselves and give ourselves some good times and recharge our batteries. But then we need to perhaps stretch ourselves and go beyond the bubbles, both in the physical sense geographically, but also in an emotional sense as well.
Sally, I want to thank you so much for trusting us with your story today. It's something that we really appreciate this.
It's been an amazing conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, thank you. And look, to listeners out there, you can get in touch with me via my website at sallygoldner.com, and love to come and talk to people more. And also, part of my future is, interestingly, I am wanting to practice as a life coach. I did not only work with a coach, but I also learnt how to be a coach, and I've never really implemented it. And I think that, you know, I just really like to do that because I'd like to share my learnings with people, well, either individually or in group settings. I'd really love to, you know, just see people achieve their sense of happiness as much as they can.
I think you'd make a fantastic mentor.
People want to get in touch with me via that website or all the modern means of social media. I'm on Twitter and Facebook as well, and LinkedIn. Please feel free to do so.
We really could have spoken to Sally for days. She has so much knowledge and experience to share.
And Sally is available for one-to-one coaching, public speaking, training, consultancy and emceeing. You can contact her by heading to sallygoldner.com.
And we'd like to thank the Pride Foundation for their support in helping to make today's episode. Next time on Reframe of Mind, board member for the Black Dog Institute, Jane Madden, joins us.
If we needed no reminder, we've certainly got one with COVID, that mental health is everyone's business. It doesn't matter whether you're a student or in corporate, in government or in the not-for-profit sector. It is everyone's business. And I think the COVID crisis has just brought a new awareness and encouraged even more conversations about mental health in Australia.
And as we try to bargain our way out of the pandemic, yearning for a return to normal or to create a new normal, are we really creating something new at all? Or are we just replicating what we've always done?
Yeah, we'll also be joined by patent interrupter for workplaces, Annie Harvey, as we sharpen our focus on mental health in the workplace.
Jim Rohn once famously said, we're the average of the five people we spend most time with. And then you're the average of those five people. So if you wanted to start looking after yourself or learning a new skill, practicing meditation or learning how to swim or whatever it is, you don't marry condo those people and ditch them out of your lives, but you start bringing people into your circle of influence that can raise that average.
You've been hearing our story, and now we really want to hear yours.
Connect with @ReframeOfMind on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok and Twitter.
Or connect with @WelcomeChangeMedia on LinkedIn.
You can also contact us via reframeofmind.com.au with your stories or suggestions for future topics.
We'd like to thank today's guests for sharing their personal stories and insights. For more information on any of the subjects, guests or references used in this episode, please see our show notes or reframeofmind.com.au.
Reframe of Mind is a Welcome Change Media production.
tired of ads crashing your comedy podcast party. Good news. Ad-free listening on Amazon Music is included with your Prime membership. Just head to amazon.com/adfreecomedy to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Enjoy thousands of Acast shows ad-free for Prime subscribers. Some shows may have ads.